You're tuned to WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn, and this is the Afternoon Magazine. In this portion of the program, The Art and Craft of the Director. Listeners, I welcome your questions about movies and directors for Robert J. Emery. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. The president and CEO of Media Entertainment Incorporated, Robert Emery, wrote, produced, and directed the Encore documentary television series, The Directors. The series featured interviews with 26 of the most acclaimed American film directors, including Robert Zemeckis, Rob Reiner, Gary Marshall, Martha Coolidge, Robert Wise, Spike Lee, and Ron Howard. The documentary programs are now available on video and DVD, and there are two companion books to the series, The Directors Take One and The Directors Take Two. Both are published by TV Books. Let me tell you more about our guest, Robert Emery, and his company, Media Entertainment, Inc. Emery has been a writer, producer, and director for 35 years. Media Entertainment projects have aired on PBS, Discovery, The Learning Channel, The Outdoor Life Channel, and Encore. Again, those telephone numbers, 800-222-WILL in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Robert Emery, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Celeste.
Right off the bat, I'd like a job description. What does a director do?
Anything he or she wants to. Well, first of all, can I make a correction?
Sure.
As of the end of the first quarter of this year, we will have, in fact, finished 52 episodes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, so since the books have come out, we've done actually 26 more television shows, and we're working on additional companion books for those episodes.
Well, that's terrific, because the first two are a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. To answer your question, what does a director do? The director really is the vision behind the entire project. Although the director may not have written the script, they're very actively involved, and of course many of them do write the scripts, but if they didn't write the script, they're actively involved in the development of that script. And they're really kind of the general, the overseer of the entire project, and it becomes their vision as to what that finished movie is going to look like, who's going to be in it, who's going to work on it, you know, what the tone and texture of the film is going to be. And so they really are the boss. They really are the trail boss. And the creative force, although there are many people that contribute to the making of a motion picture, the prime creative force is the director.
Yeah. I really enjoyed what Gary Marshall had to say about directing. He said, all you have to do is make decisions. And the key to it, he said, it's based on how artistic you can be when you're exhausted. And when you think about all the duties that and responsibilities that a director has, it can be exhausting work, or it is exhausting work.
It certainly is. I mean, you walk on an average Hollywood movie set with anywhere from 75 to 150 people, and they all want your attention. They all want you to make decisions. So it's a very difficult process. Mm-hmm. And you really have to be, you have to be of the individual that can think on their feet very, very quickly and make decisions very, very quickly. And if you can't do that, you don't survive. Hmm. Time is money.
Hmm. What kind of training and experience is needed to become a director?
That's a good question. Often none. Some people are born with the ability to get out there and do it. I think the easiest way for anyone who that has a desire to be in this business is to get some training, is to go to school, to study filmmaking, study filmmakers, and see films. You know, the old saying about if you want to be a writer, write.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you want to be a director, then you need to watch films. You need to learn the technique, the process. But certainly school is not a detriment at all, in my opinion. I think, although I don't have any schooling, I still think it's the way to go in this particular environment, in this time and day, because it's very competitive. Everybody wants to be a director.
Hmm.
That's the bottom line. And very few people are going to be directors. And that doesn't mean to say you can't go out and make a film, but it doesn't mean that you're going to go out and make a successful film. So like any other industry where you're eventually successful, I think you have to pay your dues. You start at the bottom and you learn, and hopefully somebody takes you under their wing and there's a mentor along the way. Because
yeah.
It's a very hard business, very closed business.
The stories of the directors that you tell in the series, these folks have made all kinds of movies. That said, do these folks share certain characteristics, certain experiences? Are they alike in some way or other?
Well, you know, I'm fond of saying that they're all different. And I mean that sincerely. There are no two alike, but they all do have something in common, and that's leadership. They're able to take a group of people and make them work as a cohesive group. And they're able to, the successful ones, are able to convey their ideas in such a way that people not only understand what they're trying to do, but they want to help them do what they want to do. It's very important. A movie set is like a little cocoon. I mean, it's like, I don't know, if you're shooting 6, 10, 12, 14 weeks, whatever, it's like this little cocoon where everybody is kind of isolated from the real world for that period of time. And anywhere along the line, if there's a weak link, it can affect the entire project. So the director is kind of sets the pace. Some of them rule by fear. Others, the good ones, don't. But somehow or other, they all have the ability to lead, to gather people together, and get everybody on kind of like a single mission, a single course. And that is to make this movie, to get this film, you know, in the can, the way the director envisions it. Mm. And that's an ideal explanation I just gave you.
Mm. It seems
Lord only knows that's not always the case.
It seems to me that you have to be a bit of a risk taker as well.
Very much so. Very much so, because when you go out, you have, of course, good intentions. But often, as we all know, when we go to the movies, those good intentions somehow or other didn't make it to the screen. And there, you know, there could be many reasons for that. It's not always a case of that the director failed. Could be it was the wrong material. Could be it was cast wrong. Any number of reasons. But then again, of course, you know, there are those that come together and work. One particular director we did an interview for or an episode on was Bob Zemeckis.
Mm-hmm.
And just the other night, my wife and I went to see Castaway, which is Bob's latest picture, and starring Tom Hanks. And we were stunned at what he was able to achieve with so little. By that I mean there was one guy on an island for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an example, I think, of everyone knowing what it was they wanted to do. And, you know, the listeners may not agree. Maybe some people didn't like the movie. I think the critics liked it. But I use that as an example of everything kind of coming together and working and telling the story. And that's really, a filmmaker is nothing more than telling a story.
Yeah. Zemeckis, he's quite an innovative director.
He certainly is, and I like him a lot. He's very down to earth, and he is a very commanding but humble presence. He knows what he wants. He chooses his projects carefully, and he spends a lot of time executing them. Lawrence Kasdan is another one in that same vein, where they don't make a lot of movies, but when they make them, they count.
Mm-hmm. Now, Zemeckis also directed Forrest Gump,
yes,
and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Those are two other very innovative, quite
Contact
innovative
with
films.
Contact with Jodie Foster.
Contact as well. Over time, how has he developed as a director, do you think?
I think from the very beginning, when we make these episodes, you know, I get really intimate with their careers. I don't spend a lot of time with them, unfortunately, but I get intimate with their work and their rise through the ranks. And Bob was very talented to begin with. He started out as a writer. Wrote 1941 for Steven Spielberg, which turned out to be one of Spielberg's few failures, box office failures. But Spielberg saw something in Zemeckis that said, there's talent here. And right from the beginning, his films showed great promise and a great style. And so, although he's matured, obviously, and his films get better and better, he was showing that talent right from the beginning, right from the early on. And you can look at his early films and you can say, wow, these are as enjoyable as his latest films.
Mm. The New York Times has been doing an occasional series on watching movies with directors. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't.
It's quite fascinating. Ron Howard and Curtis Hanson are two of the directors that have been featured fairly recently. And Ron Howard selected Mike Nichols' The Graduate to sit down and watch. And Hanson selected a film that I am not aware of at all, In a Lonely Place by Nicholas Ray.
Wow, I don't know that one either.
Yeah, it's a film noir. Humphrey Bogart is in it. Howard,
what was the name of it again?
In a Lonely Place.
I gotta go get that one.
Howard talked about learning from the subtleties of The Graduate, and Hanson spoke about the trust between actor and director in Ray's film, In a Lonely Place. If we were to sit down with you and watch a movie, what would you want to see?
I'm very much of the mind that the story is the most important thing. And so therefore, there are a lot of movies that come out now that don't interest me because they're more technique than substance. But I would want to see a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it doesn't have to be a complicated story. It can be a very simple story. And that's what I look for. It's hard for me to watch films because I see everything that's wrong. I just finished directing one, by the way. After many years of not doing it, I went back and directed Michael Moriarty in a film called Swimming Upstream, which is coming out this year.
Hmm.
And it was, maybe I can explain it to you by telling you why I chose that film.
Uh-huh.
I spent over a year working on the screenplay. Prior to that, I spent a year trying to find something that I wanted to do. I wanted something simple, and I wanted something that was poignant in the way that it would affect an audience emotionally. And so I found a book by a gentleman who is deceased now, by the name of Don Robinson, who wrote something like 14 books. And I fell in love with these characters. Now, that was the first step. So you have to fall in love with the characters. If you can't, then don't bother making the movie. And then it took a year to adapt the book into a screenplay. And then we went and made it. We shot it all in Rhode Island this past fall. And for me, it was all about story, about people,
mm-hmm.
characters. And I think, that harks back to the old films, the 40s, where movies were all about people, stories. Castaway, go back to Castaway just for a second here. I mean, that was about a story, about an individual that evoked a certain amount of emotion. And I think that's what I look for. And I will always look for that. If I go to a movie and it's all visual effects and what have you, that doesn't mean that I don't enjoy it. I can't even think of a quick example. Oh, I'll give you a good example. It would be Gladiator, which I just watched for the second time about 3 days ago. There was a big effects movie, and the story was pretty simple. It was a cowboy movie, really.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Western made in Rome. But I enjoyed it because I thought that Ridley Scott was able to achieve visually something that had not been achieved before, so I can appreciate that. But at the same time, if I had my druthers, I'd pick a movie that was probably more simple, straightforward, that I could get involved with the characters.
Hmm. How did you become a director?
Oh, gosh. I was with Armed Forces Radio and Television about 150 years ago. And I just had an interest in that area. I started out directing commercials, television commercials, and really back in 1967, I directed my first feature film when I was, I believe, 27 years old. I just gave away my age. But in any case, it just went from there. I just felt that it was something I wanted to do, and I've been doing it all my life, although I got away from feature films for many years, and I've been doing television series like The Directors and documentaries. I have a documentary that I'm preparing now for PBS for the fall. that I love documentaries, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating, fascinating area, almost more so than I like making films.
Mm.
But I hadn't made a film since 1975. And so when I went back this fall, it was, you know, it was like putting on the shoes for the first time.
A little scary?
Well, it was a little scary, yeah, but, yeah. But it turned out well.
Yeah.
People get into making films, I don't know, sometimes by accident, sometimes they know very young that that's what they want to do. It's surprising, actually, when you talk to these directors, that how many of them had no idea that that's what they were going to end up doing. I mean, Terry Gilliam, for instance, started out as a cartoonist. And I'm going to draw a blank here, but it goes right down the line with a lot of these people who said, you know, Billy Friedkin was doing documentaries for a television station in Chicago. Had no intentions of ever making feature films. It just worked out that way.
Yeah. He's a really fascinating guy.
A very nice guy. I like Billy a lot.
Yeah. Before we talk about Billy Friedkin, I just want to say that, you know, I think with a successful documentary that you have to have character and story.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a sense, you've been on a trajectory in the, you know, in a direction of love of character and story all your life, I would imagine.
Yes, yes. And when we set out to do the directors, you know, I had to decide what it was that I was going to do, and I basically decided that we would use very, very, very little narration, and let the directors and the guests and the film clips carry the program as much as possible, and then what we would do is we would fill in the blanks with narration, and that's what we did. And so there's not a lot of narration. It's mostly the director talking.
Mm-hmm.
And guests, and we've been very fortunate because just about everybody in Hollywood's in this series, as far as, you know, guests are concerned.
Yeah, well, with 52 now.
With 52, and I think we have over 225 actors, anywhere from Tom Cruise to Mel Gibson to you name them, and they're in the series.
Yeah.
And you know, because we do a lot of the very well-known directors, of course, and so they have an awful lot of actors that they work with that certainly are willing to come forward and speak about those experiences.
Yeah. William Friedkin, back to him as a Chicagoan. It was great fun reading about him. He started out working in the mailroom of WGN-TV, where he moved on to working on Bozo's Circus and Garfield Goose. Now, if you're from this neck of the woods, you know those shows if you're of a certain age. And I've just given away my age here. But then he went, somebody at the television station said, oh, you ought to go and see this movie, Citizen Kane. And he sat in the theater and he watched it over and over and over again, all day and into the night.
To this day, he says, you know, that he's never achieved that. I mean, he set out to, that it was his goal to make a film as good as Citizen Kane. And, you know, if you were to get him on the phone now, he'd say, nope, I haven't done it yet. Which, in a sense, is good, though. I mean, because it keeps him going.
Yeah.
Certainly, Billy has made some films that haven't been great or accepted by audiences. But then, on the other hand, you know, the body of his work is substantially on the plus side.
Yeah. One of his best known, The French Connection.
Oh, yeah.
But he said during the making of The Directors, he thought the movie was a pretty good police thriller, but outside of that, he wasn't really particularly thrilled with it.
Well, you know, I guess that's his opinion, but the audience doesn't agree with him. I think the audience thinks he made an outstanding film that holds up to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Billy's vision. Or whether he accidentally fell into it, I don't know. You know, it was an interesting story about the making of that film, and that is, of course, the chase scene, where Billy talks about not getting any clearances and not having any police help when they went off to do the point of view when they put the camera on the car. And that's pretty scary. When you think about racing through the streets of Chicago at 100 miles an hour or whatever they're going, and no one knows they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he apologizes for it and says that it should never be done again. But.
Yeah. And didn't he also give the direction that, or he didn't give much direction, he just, it was going back to his experience as a television journalist, which came before the films, you know, just, he didn't give his camera folks a lot of clues about what was going to happen, and so they were just trying to stay on top of it like it was a news story.
Well, don't you think The French Connection has kind of a documentary feel to it, though?
Yeah.
I mean, it does. And maybe that's part of what makes that film enjoyable to watch. I think that film takes you inside that film. As a viewer, I think you can get inside that film and feel like you're there, part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very hard to do, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But he achieved it.
Mm. What is success for a director?
Oh, you know, that's an excellent question, and it means a lot of things to different people. It's not always, you know, the level of a Steven Spielberg. I mean, I guess one of the best ways I can put that is Sidney Pollack said to us when we asked him what the future held and what was most exciting to him in the future. And Sidney said, I'd like to go out and make a picture for no more than $4 million. But he said, they're not going to let me do that because I make big pictures. So, you know, success to him would be a $4 million picture, or whatever the price is, as opposed to the $70 million picture that he just finished. On the other hand, you know, there's those that want what Spielberg has. And I think in the end, it's whatever satisfies you. I think most film directors make films for themselves. I don't think they make films for audiences, especially the group that we interview. They first and foremost make films for themselves. And I think it has to be that way. Because if you don't believe in what you're doing, if you're not, you know, who was it that somebody said to me, I forget which director, it'll come to me, but somebody said, you know, if I'm going to spend a year of my life, I want to love these characters. If I have to get up every day and go out and live with these characters, from the script to the shooting to the editing to the premiere, I better like these people. I better want, it might have been Gary Marshall, I don't remember.
Yeah.
I better like what I'm doing. And I think that is because, let me tell you something, it is hard work, as I just reminded myself this fall. It is hard work. Anybody that thinks it's easy and it's fun, go follow a director for 6 weeks.
Mm.
So you really better be into your script, and you better be into that story, and you better love your characters.
Yeah.
If you don't, it's going to show up in the end film.
One of the funny things that Gary Marshall told you was that, you know, change your shoes at lunchtime. always have shoes on hand. And hire an editor who likes the same kind of food you do.
Yeah, Gary's a picky eater. But, you know, that was a gag on my set because I changed shoes every day at lunch. And the first time I did it, everybody looked at me like I was crazy. And I said, no, this is what Gary Marshall said to do. This is how you make it through the day, you know. So every day after lunch, my crew would say to me, somebody would say to me, have you changed your shoes?
Mm-hmm.
And it was Coppola who told Gary that.
Probably a lot of us would be happier if we changed our shoes at lunchtime.
Yes, let me tell you, it works.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon is Robert J. Emery. He's the president and CEO of Media Entertainment. He wrote, produced, and directed the Encore documentary television series, The Directors. This series now features interviews, episodes with 52 acclaimed film directors. Also coming this year, Swimming Upstream, a feature-length film directed by our guest this afternoon, Robert J. Emery. Listeners, I invite your questions about movies and directors this afternoon in Champaign-Urbana. The telephone number, 333-9455, 333-WILL. Anywhere else you're listening, call toll-free 1-800-222-WILL. That's 800-222-9455. What do you think of the trend for re-releases today? I recently saw The Wizard of Oz, The Exorcist has played recently. A Hard Day's Night is now out, and we're expecting to see 2001 re-released. What do you make of that trend?
I don't see anything wrong with it. I think if a film is good and certain audiences, younger audiences, did not have a chance to see it, then it's good to re-release it. I mean, certainly it's all about business in the end. You don't release them for ego reasons. But I think it's good. I mean, how many times have both of us, and I'm speaking for you now, but how many times have we seen Lawrence of Arabia, for example? In any number of films that may be your favorite that you don't mind going back and seeing again. In the case of The Exorcist, I know Billy re-edited and added some stuff. So the latest version was, we can't call it a new film, but certainly it contained material that we didn't get to see the first time around.
One of the things I like about this trend is it seems to go hand in glove with the restoration of old movie houses.
Yes, yes.
Which is terrific.
I think so, yeah. Well, and so that's kind of funny in a way when so many of the newer theaters are having financial troubles, these 20-plex operations.
Yeah.
But and I, by the way, I saw Castaway the other night in a brand-new 20-theater complex, and I didn't think it was all that great a physical surrounding.
Well, I've had this experience now a couple of times in the theater in Champaign, which is being restored, the Virginia, that the audience comes into that place with a different kind of attitude than the multiplex. And people will applaud when the curtain opens and the opening credits roll, and they'll applaud at the end.
It's the same way here. I live in Tampa, and it's the same way here with the Tampa Theater, which is an old restored theater. It's a different experience, a totally different experience than the sterile surround sound popcorn vending places they're building.
Also, another good thing about this trend is that many of these films that are being re-released, a lot of us have only seen them on television, and there's certainly a big, big difference there.
And, of course, you know, the access now to DVD brings to your television set the best quality that film ever achieved. And in some cases, even more so.
Yeah.
Because they're restored.
And the DVD can also include lots of other information.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I watched the DVD the other night when I rewatched Gladiator. I had seen Gladiator in the theaters to begin with. And saw it on DVD the other night. And there was a companion CD with it that contained all kinds of stuff. There was much material on that second disc than there was with the movie. It was two behind-the-scenes making of the films and an extensive interview with the composer and the director and all of the scenes that were deleted were on there. So it's quite an experience.
Who's putting these things together? Who's compiling these DVDs and deciding, you know, well, let's put an interview with the composer on this DVD. Let's put an interview with the director on this DVD.
Well, you know, oddly enough, the director has a lot of control over that, especially the big ones. You can't do anything with their movies that they're not involved with. Excuse me. The creative process remains with the director, even though the movie is owned by Paramount or Disney or whoever owns the film. Contracts usually give the director an awful lot of say in what will be done with the material other than the primary movie. And often, I know when The Sound of Music was redone, Robert Wise, the director of that film, was brought in to oversee the restoration of that film. And so, I don't know, maybe he had it in his contract, although he's one of the owners of that film, that may not be a good example, but often, in the case of The Exorcist, Billy was brought in to redo that. I mean, he oversaw that entire project. So the director stays creatively involved, and as well they should.
We've got some listeners waiting to talk with us. Let's go to our first caller this afternoon in Chicago on line 4. Good afternoon.
Thank you. It's wonderful hearing this discussion. One night before last on WGN Radio in Chicago, they had a 2-hour discussion with some of the local film critics, and film review people for the Catholic groups and so forth. And among them, they felt that there was not a single movie this past year that they could really say was great. They could say good, very good, but not one that they thought was great. And I was wondering if you thought similarly along those lines, or what you thought might have been great if you did find one.
I don't know what they mean by great.
Right. Well, you know, of the status of probably some... like we were talking about Gladiator before, they did discuss that a bit about its visual aspects and how it was based quite a bit on Spartacus.
Yes.
And things that maybe like 2001 was great in its time as a breakthrough in science fiction, etc. You know, it's so different, Gone with the Wind. Who knows what everyone thinks of as great during its time. But to limit the production and the general revenue of the films, do you find that the directing and producing is being hampered by the spin-off towards products that are going to tie in with the film as a, you know, greater sales revenue-producing enhancement for the whole, you know, banking and financial backers, rather than, like you're saying, you've had to find a script, a story, fall in love with the characters and go through it, but is it going to create that revenue that the backers and all them want? Is it being limited by that much, too?
Well, certainly when a film is made with the idea of selling toys and games and
yeah.
all that stuff, I mean, then that film is fashioned for that purpose.
Yeah, well,
and I'm not so sure that that's bad. I mean, it's called commerce. These people
right.
are entitled to make a profit. But on the other hand, I don't know that that's the formula that has to be followed all the time. I mean, certainly when a filmmaker makes a film, it's a very personal journey. It is. I don't care what film it is. It's a very personal journey. They're up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they're sweating bullets all day, and they're lucky if they get to bed at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, whatever it is, it becomes a personal journey. But there is, you know, Hollywood is a place to make money, and so they are constantly sitting around conference tables trying to figure out the next gimmick. In the case of Gladiator, I think it's a great film only because technically Ridley was able to achieve certain things that had not been seen on a screen before. Now, does that make it a great movie? I don't know. I'm just simply saying that what he accomplished was good.
Yeah.
And certainly, I think the story was really simple, maybe overly simplified.
Yeah, and
we've
then
seen that story 100 times before.
Then you have the matter of a director who is also the writer of the film, producer, and also wants to be the actor, trying to do all the things in one basket, so to speak, and... Quite often, he has a hard time doing it all together, but some have attained that, a la, say, Orson Welles and a few others. Do you ever think of anyone else that you could think and come to mind that would fit that category?
No.
Chaplin,
I guess the
maybe?
Closest one that comes to achieving it nowadays, at least getting it done, and I don't know how great he is, but Clint Eastwood does that.
And maybe Woody Allen now and then.
And Woody, but, you know, Woody Allen's films acquire, you have to acquire a taste for those.
Yes.
Woody's films don't make a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to seeing yours. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we go to a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Sorry about that. Hi. I understand your expertise is really in American directors, or...
Yes.
Okay.
Well, actually, we just finished an episode with Alan Parker.
Uh-huh.
Mike Lee.
Uh-huh.
Who did the...
Mike Lee just did the... can't think of the name. It's the one about the Gilbert and Sullivan?
No. Mike's recent project was the split screen...
Oh, right. Oh, Time Code.
And who did, I'm having a senior moment here. I just finished the episode. I can't think of the guy's name. Irish director who did Interview with a Vampire. In any case, we're doing some foreign directors. That's the point I was trying to make.
My question was really about American women directors. If you've been able to interview very many, if you can.
Barbara Streisand and Martha Coolidge, that's it.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Because for whatever reason, American film directors, women film directors, have chosen not to come forward. I've invited Penny Marshall any number of times. She's come up with excuses any number of times. Her brother Gary told me good luck getting her in front of the camera. Although she did appear on Gary's episode, she was a guest. Who did we...
Jodie Foster?
Jodie turned us down because she felt that she had not completed enough film.
Hmm.
Uh-huh. Would you ever have a chance?
I know Jodie, and she's a lovely gal, and she's been a guest on our show, but she just felt that she wasn't ready to talk about, you know, that she's directed two films.
Would you ever have a chance to interview Jane Campion?
We've invited Jane. Jane has accepted for the next series.
Great. Uh-huh.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. And Elaine May?
Elaine, I think, turned us down. Yeah. And who's the lady who did You've Got Mail? Oh, gosh.
Maybe a listener will help us out.
Yeah, married to Bob Woodward. Or was it Bernstein? I forget. In any case, again, we got turned down. So I don't know what it is about the ladies who don't want to come forth and talk about their work, because we feel that the series has been lopsided toward men, and we've really tried to get more fine women directors on, but they just don't seem to want to do it.
Yeah. Well, one insight, perhaps, comes from Martha Coolidge.
Well,
she said that a producer took her aside at one point and said, whatever you do, don't tell anyone you want to be a director.
Yeah.
She said, they don't want you to be a director. You've got to get your nails done. You've got to wear lashes. You've got to wear makeup. Look nice. And whatever you do, tell them all you want to do is be an assistant. So it seems to me that there's still an awful lot of pressure, and the climate might still be a little chilly out there.
It is, and I think it will remain so for a while because it's a man's world out there. I don't know why. I think we need more women making films, frankly. But I give you maybe even a better example, because Martha came up through the ranks. She worked her way up through the ranks the hard way. She wasn't a celebrity, and she was just a filmmaker who was going to get out there and get it done. And she's got the personality that will get it done. But to give you a better example of the difficulty of women in Hollywood, we did a show on Barbara Streisand, and many people said to me, why do you want to do Barbara? She's only directed three films. And I felt that Barbara, who could probably do anything she wants to do in this world, would have insight as to what it's like to be a woman in Hollywood. And so we did this interview with her, and it's dynamite. And it's dynamite because Barbara said, you know, no matter who you are, considering who I am, I still have difficulty getting a movie made because of I'm a woman.
Mm.
And I thought that was interesting, because you would think she'd pick up the phone and say, I want to make a movie next week, and everybody would throw money at her. And it's not the way it happens. But, I don't know why. I really don't know the answer. I mean, again, as I said earlier, I think we need more women making films. It brings another point of view.
Yeah. Well, with Streisand, she's often said to be very difficult to work with, but no. I think that that's a horrible thing to say. I mean, if somebody's demanding and wants things done right, well, you know, what's wrong with that?
I don't think Barbara's difficult at all. I think that I think men are intimidated because Barbara knows what she wants. Barbara doesn't scream and yell at people. I've interviewed a number of people about this, and she doesn't scream and yell at people. She doesn't make unreasonable demands. Her attitude in life is there's a right way and the wrong way, and if you're going to work with me, we're going to try to do it the right way. Well, if that intimidates you, then you shouldn't work with Barbara.
Hmm.
I don't think Barbara's reputation is well-deserved.
Yeah.
Her bad reputation.
Yeah. Yentl comes to mind. That was one of the films she directed.
Yentl and The Mirror Has Two Faces and
Let me look. I'll look it up here while we continue to talk.
The one in South Carolina, Pat Conroy's book.
Yeah.
Prince of Tides.
Prince of Tides. Okay. Yeah. But Prince of Tides and Yentl. I particularly am a big fan of Yentl. I think this is a beautiful film.
Yes. I thought that she kind of lost it on The Mirror Has Two Faces. I didn't think that was all that great, but. Still a very well-made film. You know, you have to give a director some credit for being able to technically pull it all together. Because you can have the finest crew in the world, but if you don't have your act together, they don't have their act together.
How much say do directors have over what they will direct?
Actually, they have total say. Yeah, I mean, you don't have to do anything you don't want to do. A lot of films get turned down by a lot of directors who don't feel they're right for the material. I think a good director you know, looks at this not as a payday, and I emphasize good here, underline, capitalize, quote, not as a payday, but as something that they feel they can bring some insight to. And I believe most directors are that way. I really do.
Hmm. But it seems also that directors have to be producers in some cases if they want to see something come to fruition.
Well, in the case of Swimming Upstream, it was totally that. This company financed it. This company found it. This company made it. Because I don't think anybody else was going to jump on the bandwagon and make this film. It was too small a film, too intimate a story.
Mm.
And so a lot of times directors will be their own producers, go out and find the money, get it financed, and get it made. And they literally are the ones that get it made. I think the public would be surprised and amazed at the number of directors who are considered top directors who have had projects that go languishing because nobody will touch them.
Mm.
So, you know, it's not like, yeah, I mean, I guess maybe Steven Spielberg can make anything he wants, but he's smarter than that. He's only going to make what he really believes in. And, of course, Steven now is responsible for making money for a lot of people. But you're still not going to get him to make something that he doesn't believe in. It's not going to be about a payday. So I think from the smallest director to the biggest director, it goes back to what I said. You better love the story. You better love the characters, or don't get up in the morning, because it's going to end up being a hard day.
Yeah, got to live with it for a long time.
Right.
A listener has called in and supplied some answers to some questions that
we
posed. Mike Lee, Topsy Turvy, and others. Time code, Mike Figgis.
I'm sorry. I said Mike Lee, and I meant Mike Figgis.
Mike Figgis. And Nora Ephron.
Nora is the one that I've been chasing. And, you know, we make this series in conjunction with, in cooperation with the American Film Institute. And I even had Gene Furstenberg, who's the head of the American Film Institute, ask Nora personally. And Nora just said, no, I haven't done enough work. One of these days we'll convince her otherwise.
Yeah. Well, one of the surprising things to me is to think about the tenacity. And I guess maybe it's not surprising when you think about it, when you stop to think about it. But a lot of these folks have had flops. And some of these folks have had flops in a row. And, you know, a guy who's right now riding high, Steven Soderbergh, has had a number of hits. But, you know, it wasn't all that long ago he had a string of 2-3 that didn't go anywhere.
Right.
But now he's got Traffic, and then earlier in the year, last year, Aaron Brockovich.
Well, because I think in his case he's making more mainstream pictures. I believe he directed Kafka.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 6 people saw it. 5 others besides me. And yet it is a beautifully crafted film. It is extremely well made and well directed, but the subject matter wasn't for mass audiences. And I think Steven now has made 2 pictures that are more mainstream. I read something recently about that, and I don't remember exactly what he said, but it was basically the same thing as, you know, he started looking at more mainstream stuff, or he was going to languish in the middle, the gray area, forever.
Mm-hmm. Somebody that you talked to in the directors, I believe it was either one or two, take one or take two, is that we're not making films to hang on the wall of some closeted museum. We're
right.
Making films for people to watch.
I remember that, but I don't remember who said it.
Well,
52 directors later, I don't remember.
Yeah, our apologies to whoever did say that. But
right.
The time has flown by. Robert, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
I want to thank you. It's been most enjoyable.
Robert Emery has been our guest this afternoon. He's the president and CEO of Media Entertainment Incorporated. He wrote, produced, and directed the Encore documentary television series, The Directors. The series now features interviews with 52 directors. Also, look for his feature film, which will be coming out later this year, Swimming Upstream.